come you masters of war. You that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand.
This story, my story, starts with the war in 1991. Ladies and gentlemen, George H.W. Bush, 41st President of the United States of America.
Regrettably, the noon deadline passed without the agreement of the government of Iraq to meet demands of United Nations Security Council Resolution 660, as set forth in the specific terms spelled out by the coalition, to withdraw unconditionally from Kuwait. To the contrary, what we have seen is a redoubling of Saddam Hussein's efforts to destroy completely Kuwait and its people. I have therefore directed General Norman Schwarzkopf, in conjunction with coalition forces, to use all forces available, including ground forces, to eject the Iraqi army from Kuwait.
Of January the 17th, 1991, hundreds of coalition aircraft took to the skies and headed for their targets.
Operation Desert Storm had begun. British RAF pilots in low-flying Tornado aircraft carried bombs designed to crater Iraqi runways. The Americans' first target was Iraq's capital. From the rooftops of Baghdad, 3,000 anti-aircraft guns fired into the night.
As the skies of Baghdad lit up with anti-air fire and American strike fighters flew to their targets, my family huddled in our tenement apartment in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, about 1,000 kilometers away from Baghdad, Iraq. The war had started for us earlier. The American military had taken over King Khalid International Airport a few weeks ago as the main operations base for the Gulf War. It was going to be the hub in the wheel of the American military operation by serving as a central point for all troop and military equipment movement during the war. Riyadh had gone from being a busy capital city into a staging area for military sorties. The battleship carrier groups had come with their scores and scores of strike fighters, gunships, helicopters, missiles, guns, and artillery. And they had just kept coming, day and night, day and night. The city became dead, preparing for the war, expecting the worst. As a six-year-old, I didn't know enough to be scared, but I noticed when we had eggs for dinner for the fifth night in a row. I noticed that our TV just showed images of black planes that would haunt my dreams later. And I noticed that my father brought us gas masks from the military base. We were told to practice putting on the gas masks. A children's gas mask, as opposed to an adult version, has a long tube running to the gas canister, giving it the appearance of having a trunk. My brother, sister, and I pretended to be elephants running around our frustrated parents. Then the sirens started to go off. I didn't understand what their wailing meant, but I knew it was time to put on my gas mask and go sit with my brother and sister on the floor. We would stay there just looking at each other as the sirens continued to blare. It was later that I found out that Saddam had launched missiles towards Riyadh during the early stages of the war. The air raid sirens would turn on whenever a missile was incoming. We spent much of the war surviving on stale food and taking our gas masks on and off between rounds of sirens. I didn't understand why my city had to go through this, why my family had to go through this for a conflict that, as far as I could tell, was unrelated to either me or my family, or the city in which we lived. Strike fighters and attack helicopters roared over our heads all day and night long. After the war, the city collapsed economically, and xenophobia spread like wildfire. Arab jobs for Arabs, my family had to leave. We packed up all our lives into boxes and immigrated abroad. The airplanes and helicopters stayed.
Land of dreams, come and be free, free, free. Raise your family. Promises, 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 promises. Drive your taxi, work your jobs. No protection, money is gas. Promises, 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 promises.
Now we travel 14 years into the future. It's another late night as I sit in front of my computer programming for my new project at work. I started 2 months ago at this engineering firm as a computer programmer. I have thoroughly enjoyed the work. I've been spending late nights trying to get more work done so that I can be assigned to even more complex and exciting projects. Needless to say, I don't get overtime, so I've been working for the company for free. But hey, it's exciting work. Who wouldn't put in the extra time, right? But one night, my past comes back to haunt me. One particular night, I'm putting the finishing touches on a software module that will test hull strength for airplanes. My boss had assigned me the project, and I had taken it without asking him anything about it. I punch in the last changes, save it, and submit it, curious to see how it will run. I load up the test cases for my hull strength testing software and hit run. I don't pay any attention to the test cases at first. But then as the various airplanes are loaded up on my screen and tested, it slowly dawns on me. Every single one of those planes is a military warplane. In fact, there's a US Air Force logo on the bottom of each test case. They have me developing software to make better military warplanes? I watch in horror as the same death machines that drove my family from our home are tested using the software I developed. I push back on my office chair, and I'm about to throw up. This, of course, begs the question of how a child who had grown up through the worst excesses of military technology and imperialism ended up working on the very machines that had blotted out the skies of his home during an invasion. Why had I forgotten that past? Why had my career led me to this? Why do engineers design for war? Did I have to?
Definitely not. I don't think, but they have to be pretty aware of what's going on, because I think many good and well-intentioned students end up working for the oppressive technology company, maybe directly or more often indirectly. You know, maybe just providing parts for a company that provide parts for an oppressive technology company, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really easy to get engaged in the industrial military complex without really knowing about it. So I think the students really need to be deeply engaged. The students who are deeply engaged to go into these conversations about what is really behind engineering and the engineering industry, especially connected to engineering education, the people who are engaged in thinking about that backdrop have more of an opportunity to escape it.
This was Jonathan Vandersteen, a postdoctoral candidate at the University of Guelph in the School of Engineering. His research concentrates on engineering, education, and social justice. Although it might be easy to see how weapons can be oppressive and harmful to people, other technologies are not as obvious in their harm. Jonathan, how would other technologies be harmful or oppressive?
I think of oppressive technology as any technology that's not necessarily designed in a democratic way, that it's something that has come from a larger power taking advantage of, you know, a bulk of a population that doesn't benefit from this technology. It is just the larger power that benefits, you know. So obviously military is the most obvious example. You know, many workers work to produce these products. They're not necessarily benefiting from it. It's the larger state that benefits from these sorts of things. So that's certainly a case of oppressive technology. You know, how easy is this going to be to define? I mean, it's not at all. But I would put something like, for example, something related to biotechnology, genetic engineering, new crops, new seeds that require a specific pesticide to work with. I think that's all an oppressive technology because it's not something that can be enjoyed by the bulk of the people.
And why are technologies oppressive? Well, isn't technology neutral? It shouldn't harm or hurt specific people.
You can never have neutral technology. It's like saying, can you ever be a reporter and report on a story in a non-biased way? They can claim that they have attempted to be as critical as possible and to respond to something based on as much experience, you know, by looking at a story from as many different perspectives as possible. But you're always going to be influenced by who you are and where you've come from and the way you understand the world. Same thing is the case with engineering design. We design based on who we are and where we've come from. And as soon as we ask a question, as soon as we ask a design question or a research question, intrinsic into that question is who we are and, you know, what sort of reality we want to, that we come from. Is that a bad thing? Well, of course not. We can't be anybody but us, right? It's bad when we don't strive to try to understand other realities in as broad of a way, and that we can do our design with a sense of humility and with a sense of justice. If you don't do that and you claim objectivity, you're not doing anybody a favor, and that is when technologies become the most oppressive.
So Jonathan says technology is not neutral. It has values embedded into it.
For your just desserts, it's not just the words. Some of y'all heads up in the cloud, I'ma bring y'all back to earth. It's black back and burn, bullshit y'all talking about. Out your mouth, I'm not concerned, cause y'all got to learn. It's y'all turned like Detroit Red, when his head had an ultra perm. The long walk to burn, your bare heels soaked the worn your boots. The game camouflage.
So why are engineers so blind to the values in the technology they create? Why don't they see how technology can be oppressive to people?
I think engineers are bad at that sort of a process because they have a real arrogance about their discipline. And it is completely, completely constructed by the students, by professors, by parents, by society in general, by other students of other faculties, everything.
That was Amy Bautenhaus. She is an undergraduate engineer at Queen's University, majoring in geography and applied math.
I was being a teaching assistant for a first-year course this year, and a student in the class was talking about how to make design processes in an equitable way and in a just way. And the student said, you know, people in commerce often think about only profits, and they don't know anything. And we as engineers need to show them why they are wrong. And the class erupted in cheering and laughing and blatant mockery of people in commerce. And that kind of arrogance can be seen also in students' attitudes towards arts and science students. Engineers at Queen's, at least, are constantly talking about art size and how they don't do any work and how they have so much free time and engineers are so busy. And there are many, many, many people at the university, arts and science students, who echo those same thoughts, who say, oh, wow, you're an engineer. You must be so busy. You must be really smart. And all of that perpetuates this idea that engineers are experts, that engineers have something really, really important and valuable to say, and in fact, more valuable than other people. It's also perpetuated in the way that professors talk. Even professors make comments like, our classes are so difficult, and our classes are hard. Our first year physics course is harder than the than the arts and science physics course, and our math courses are harder than the math students' courses. And all of that creates this atmosphere within the faculty of complete arrogance. And often engineers feel that they are better than other people at making decisions, at problem solving, at critical thinking. That makes it really hard for an engineer to engage in a participatory project because I'm the engineer, I know how water flows, I know how concrete settles, I know the loading on the beam that's going to support the well is going to have to be a certain height or width or whatever because I've taken so many years and I've gone through rigorous labs and I've written a whole bunch of assignments, but what does that really teach you about actually building a well or interacting with people and trying to think about the social aspects of a technology or the way that technologies are not neutral.
Didn't you know it would cause so much bloodshed? Didn't you know you will have so many dead? Can't you see disease eating mankind, yeah? Eating mankind.
A group of young Canadian engineers decided to go to Ghana to work with one particular community there. In that community, the women were responsible for getting water and using that water for household tasks. The women would get up every morning and go to the closest drilled well, which was 3 hours away. Going back and forth would mean the woman would have to walk for 6 hours every day carrying jugs of water. The engineers clearly saw a need for a drilled well closer to the community. These enterprising engineers reasoned, if their well is closer to the village, the women don't have to walk as far or be away from their homes for as long, not to mention the labor it would save in carrying the water from the well. So these young engineers went ahead and drilled the well. While they did ask some people in the community for their thoughts on the well, it never occurred to the engineers that the women might have something to say. After they drilled the well, they told the women in the community to use the well, since it was clearly better, so the women started to use the well. Content with their accomplishment, the engineers returned to Canada. Using a follow-up grant, the same engineers went back to the community 6 months later where they had previously worked. They were surprised to find out that the women were no longer using the well. Instead, they were traveling to the well that was 3 hours away. They were perplexed at this seemingly irrational behavior. Curious to know what had happened, some of the engineers from the group started to interview community members, including women. Community members kept mentioning that there was a rash of suicides around the time the community stopped using the closer well. These rash of suicides had apparently disappeared when the community started to use the well that was located 3 hours away. The engineers were even more confused, because how do suicides relate to their well? Why were the women telling them this? One of the younger women finally told the engineers what had happened. The woman had appreciated the well and had used it quite frequently as it was more convenient. However, the well had taken away from the time women socialized with each other and the time they were away from home. Since the well was located within the community, the woman did not have the 6 hours to socialize with each other away from the burdens of motherhood and running a household. This important social mechanism was lost, and many of the women became isolated and overworked. This led many of them to commit suicide, as they lost relationships with fellow women and could no longer cope with their workloads. Seeing the effects of the new well, the women gradually shifted back to using the well that was located 3 hours away.
Technology isn't neutral because technology is empowerment to achieve a certain kind of end. So it's not neutral in its use. But nor is it neutral in its structure or creation, because it necessarily marginalizes certain people to certain kinds of ways of knowing.
That was Imran Ali. Imran, go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Sayed Imran Ali, PhD candidate at the University of Guelph in Water Resources Engineering. I'm also the project coordinator for the Alternative Water Systems Project, which is a research collaboration between the University of Guelph, Queen's University, and the Indian Institute of Technology in Madras, and we're working on developing safe water systems for slums in South Asia.
So Imran, how can technology be unjust?
If technology, the technological design process is done without consideration for outcomes, and how it relates to power relations in society, chances are they'll reinforce the status quo.
And technology that reinforces the status quo would be?
The obvious examples are like, say, military technologies, right? They empower certain groups. They create a great differential that another group can't compete with. In the other way of looking at technology in terms of its usage, because the means of production were held by a certain class, and they were the only ways of competing by virtue of levels of production in that kind of economy, the workers were progressively disempowered by the technology as it was used.
So Imran, how can engineers disempower or empower people using technology?
So engineers can disempower people by giving them systems that, for a basic necessity, for which the supply chains are controlled by other people, right? So then you become dependent on the provision of a certain kind of input to get the output that you want, right? So let's say we're talking about, go back to the example of water treatment. Say Canada works with India to enhance water quality in its cities and says, use our membrane technology developed at University of Guelph. Now, the people living in these communities served by these systems have very good quality water, but they're entirely dependent on Canada maintaining good relations with India and keeping the supply chains open. Whereas if India said, you know, we don't have this membrane technology yet, but we have this advanced filtration technology, let us use that in our systems. We then have, you know, control over our supply chains. We then have the means to reproduce that service without requiring the goodwill or cooperation of an entity that has different interests. So to empower would mean to use local capacity, and this is something that really all those appropriate technology people talk about, is using local materials, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I never really thought about it this way, but that's really actually quite profound. They usually talk about it in terms of cost, right?
Mm-hmm.
Local stuff is cheaper,
mm-hmm.
and it's more accessible. But really what it means is that people have control over
right.
the output. If you have control over the input, you maintain total power over
mm-hmm.
the supply of citizens, right?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what my research looks at. I am a master's candidate in the Department of Civil Engineering at Queen's University, who is exploring what a socially just design process would look like. This design process, or the way engineers design, would empower people, be humble towards them, and recognize how values within technology can be harmful. How can we as engineers design technology that is not racist or misogynistic or colonial in an inclusive manner that recognizes that non-engineers have much to contribute?
We come back to the idea of humility. But what we need to do is we need to foster a sense of what does inclusivity mean in engineering. One of the most important things for every person, not just the engineers, to understand is that inherent in all of us is, you know, a hatred of the other, a hatred of the different. You know, we're all sexist, we're all racist, we're all homophobic, and we have to fight those sorts of things. When we come to a place where we can recognize that, we can then be a better, more inclusive engineer, or a better, more inclusive designer. When I talk about inclusivity, I'm saying that in that design cycle, the most important constraint in the design cycle is to make sure that you have considered the most marginalized of all the stakeholders, that you have, you know, that these decisions are being made not just by the person who knows how to solve the equations, but that the decisions are being made through consultation, not just with the wealthy stakeholders, but with all stakeholders. This is why the whole idea of consensus decision-making and anti-oppression needs to be a part of engineering decision-making.
The other problem engineers face in design is what Imran has called designing in affluence. As Canadian engineers, we design in a setting with unlimited resources. We always have unlimited raw material. If we don't, we can just mine it out of Sudan. We always have unlimited markets to sell our technology in. If we don't, we can just sign a free trade agreement with another South American country. This ability to design in affluence, of course, leads to oppressive or harmful technology. How can we as engineers not design in affluence so that we may be environmentally and socially responsible?
Okay, so designing in affluence is just kind of one symptom of a kind of just myopia of design, right? We're also designing in organization. We're also designing with access to materials. We're also designing with community social structures. We're also designing with legal infrastructure. We're also designing with social organization, right? We're taking all these aspects, right, and there's many more, and they're implicit to our design. Now, how do we train people to step back from their positionality, right? That's what we're asking. I think for engineers, an effective way of doing that will be to ask on the downstream end, what are the implications of a technology? So, like with this example of centralized versus decentralized water treatment systems, you can see that they kind of tend towards certain forms of social organization. So then you can say that a technology is not neutral, right? Because it influences the social environment around it. So it does have a social and political and economic presence. Once you see the downstream effects, right, we can say to ourselves, okay, we see our design product has these downstream effects. What is it about our process of designing that encourages certain kinds of social or downstream outcomes, let's say, right? We would then be aware, critically, I think, of the values that are implicit to our design process.
Another aspect of engineering that I examined in my thesis is its authoritative and capitalist nature. Right now, engineers are taught to be competitive and taught their expert, rational knowledge overrides other ways of knowing. Instead, we must move towards a cooperative method of design that is responsive to its locality instead of being responsive to the needs of the market. I want to create an engineering that is more democratic and open.
Democratization of science is where decisions are made, and the decisions in this case would be the decisions made by the manufacturers, the community members, the end users, the people who are related to the project or the product, and that these decisions are made with everybody's voice being heard, not that a product is made and the user is told with very manipulative messages that this is the product you want. You know, we can think of an example of a neighborhood being designed, and you know, the people who are going to live in that neighborhood come together to discuss what are the features of that neighborhood, or what are the features of a community center. When you have multiple voices being put into place to make the decisions, that is more where the decision has been democratized. It's done based on the voices of the people. It's much easier to show that the bulk of the technology that's developed is not a democracy. It's not what the people want or need, but more what is necessary for, you know, for the larger neoliberal discourse, the people who control it, right?
However, a more democratic and anti-global and anti-capitalist engineering is not possible if we remain exclusively reliant on numbers and quantitative data. Numbers can be oppressive in the way they're used and in the way they exclude certain non-quantitative ways of knowing. After all, how can the effect of landfill sites on Aboriginal land in Canada be quantified in any way? Engineers must do much more to move away from quantitative ways of knowing.
Certainly the people who pay the bills, they want indicators, right? They want to know the effectiveness of their money. They want to know how things are. It wasn't that many years ago that Europeans went through this age of enlightenment where it was really believed that man was perfectible and reason was the ultimate of all virtues, and reason required us, you know, mathematics was the language of reason, and everything was quantified. I mean, it's the perfect language of modernity, right? Want to do a risk analysis? Well, you know, your outcome is going to be two numbers, and you pick the lower number, right? And you know, it's only now that, you know, in the last 10 years or so that, you know, scientists are realizing that, you know, those methods of risk analysis were problematic. But there's something that was, you know, it's in our history that numbers talk, science rules. Quantifiable and objective numbers are powerful. It's a great reductionist system. You know, I can't possibly understand everything, so I don't need to understand everything. Show me the numbers, right? And that's a problem.
I'll leave you with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. from his book, Strength to Love. Our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men. I would like to thank Amy Bautenhaus, Jonathan Vandersteen, and Imran Ali for their time. The audio clips of the Persian Gulf War were taken from CNN footage. I would also like to thank Chris Trimmer and the rest of the CFRC staff and community for their help on this project. This was Osman Mushtaq.
I like it so far, man. Yeah. Come on, let's go. Welcome to the United Snakes, land of the thief, home of the slave. Grand Imperial Guard, where the dollar is sacred and proud. Let's do the shit real, come on now. Smoke and mirrors, stripes and stars, stoning for the cross in the name of God. Bloodshed, genocide, rape and fraud, written to the pages of the law, good law. The cold continent latchkey child ran away one day and started acting foul. King of where the wild things are, daddy's proud, cause the Roman Empire done died.